We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Plenty to...
Let's get started.
Yes, why not? Shall we? Let's begin. All right, starting with a poll, Elway poll out this week.
Yeah, this week there was a new Elway poll. They asked residents of King County what their attitudes were towards the fact that we didn't get the Sacramento Kings basketball team to move to Seattle. We, yes. And the response was...
I think one person was trying to get the Sacramento
Kings.
Yeah,
and the response was exactly what you might expect if you live in the real world. About two-thirds of the respondents said that they either don't care or they had no opinion about whether or not the Sonics ever come back or the Sacramento Kings were ever able to get them. Approximately 51% said they don't care. 12% said they were actually glad, and 4% had no opinion. That's, when you add all those together, you get 67%, which is two-thirds of respondents in King County. Only one-third were disappointed, and of those, only 18% were very disappointed, while the remaining 15 were only mildly disappointed. And of the respondents, about one-third of them were Seattle residents, and the rest were residents from other parts of King County. And what this poll really found is that there's no particular difference, you know, from attitudes prior to the bid for the Sacramento Kings. It's really no different from the results of other polls, which has shown that it's just a very, very vocal minority that thinks we should have an NBA team regardless of the cost.
It's a very vocal minority, but that minority has a huge bullhorn because local media has a huge incentive in promoting this. Because, you know, TV stations and the Seattle Times and et cetera, sports talk radio, they all make money off having another pro sports team in Seattle.
Yes, that's true.
I guess that's the part where they say that pro sports bring a lot of money into a city.
Yeah, well, or at least into Mercer Island where the Bluffins live.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on down to Olympia, the House and Senate.
Yeah, the latest special session of the state legislature in Olympia has to come up with a unified budget proposal from the House and Senate by this coming Tuesday, or they will be forced to essentially go to yet another special session in order to try to come up with a budget proposal for the next biennium, which they're required to do by state law. The Senate, of course, this year, controlled by a minority of Republicans, along with a couple of Democratic defectors led by alleged Democrat Rodney Tom from the East Side, and the House continues to be controlled, as it has been for many years, by the Democratic Party. The House Democrats released their budget offer that they have to reconcile with the Democrats on Wednesday. That offer attempts to compromise with the more conservative Republican original Senate offer. So it includes $800 million, which is short of the billion plus that's needed to comply with the state Supreme Court's mandated education spending for K-12 this year. It abandons the extension of a B&O tax surcharge on services that would cost about $500 million in revenue that would otherwise come in. And it closes only 7 rather than the originally proposed 11 tax loopholes, the various corporate tax loopholes that essentially amount to corporate welfare and don't really contribute to the state economy except for the pockets of a few very wealthy stockholders. So it's certainly not an ideal budget. That money, again, coming out of education, coming out of social services and so forth. But it's an attempt to compromise with the Senate Republicans. So the Republicans on Thursday, Senate Majority Leader Rodney Tom calls a press conference to announce his counterproposal. His press conference lasted 6 minutes. You can watch it on YouTube, and it won't take long to watch that press conference. And it was basically one of the more bizarre press conferences in the history of press conferences, at which he announced that, we have a comprehensive counterproposal, but we're not going to release any of the details of it because, well, you know, we wouldn't want to jeopardize the negotiating process. Well, they wouldn't be at the end of another special session at a complete impasse if there were a negotiating process. But the fact that you have one chamber of the state legislature that is now being controlled by a party that for ideological reasons is refusing to acknowledge any revenue increases or any extension of existing revenue that is reduced to scheduled to expire. That's what the B&O tax extension is about. And that, for that matter, the tax loophole isn't about new taxes. It's about closing loophole that allows corporations to pay less taxes than they should owe. They're refusing to compromise on any of this. And so it could be a very, very long summer in Olympia.
Yeah. And just to add to that, you can argue, and I think this is very true, that the legislature is already in violation of state law, since state law says that a budget needs to be passed within 30 days of the beginning of the fiscal year. The fiscal year starts July 1st, so the budget should have been passed by June 1st, and we're long past that deadline. So even while they are in violation of the law, the Republican majority in the Senate feel no urgency to try to come to any kind of an agreement.
Of course, this is a legislature also that has been violating the law and the Constitution by not funding K through 12 education adequately for
yes.
many years. So,
this budget, yeah, and this
nothing new.
This budget, which according to the state Supreme Court decision, the McCleary decision, which said that the state has to do its constitutional duty and adequately fund K through 12 education by putting in at least another $1 billion, which really by now, since the McCleary decision was a little ways in the past, that amount they have to fund it is about $1.5 billion now. This budget only funds about $700 million additional $1 million for K through 12 education. So it's not even really half of what's needed, which will put the state in jeopardy of a further lawsuit.
Yeah,
and sanctions by the court.
And that level, the $700 million to $800 million. Even that, the Republicans are balking at.
Yeah.
All right. That moves us on then to national and
they're watching.
Big news this week.
They're listening.
With the surveillance state.
Yes, Glenn Greenwald's articles. He's actually been interviewed here on Mind Over Matters, hasn't he?
No, we've carried him.
We've carried his talks.
His
okay.
He
published a couple of articles this week in The Guardian, a newspaper in the UK, not here in the United States, of course, but in Britain, about U.S. government surveillance of U.S. citizens, not just foreign citizens. One of them had to do with publishing the Verizon court order. By now, you probably know what that is. It's a routine renewal of a standing order for the FBI to collect all phone records from the Verizon business customers, not just for foreign
Do we know that? Because I know in Greenwald's original article, he said it wasn't clear whether it was a standing order or not.
He said that it wasn't clear, but then intelligence experts looked at the order and they said, oh, no, this would be part of a series.
Okay.
It would be a renewal of
a standing order. And then we also
and
weren't
that
clear
it
whether it was
appeared.
Only Verizon or whether it was all the carriers.
Well, and then they said that it also appeared that it would apply to all the other carriers as well. So what this order, the fact that this one order was leaked, what it shows is that the FBI is doing ongoing data collection. What they're collecting is phone numbers. They're collecting information on what time of day the phone calls were made, the elapsed time of the calls, and other
and the location.
The location and other identifiers of the call, like which particular cell phone or which particular landline, etc. In addition, his second article was about an NSA program called PRISM, which sweeps up and analyzes all the emails and internet usage information on nine US-based internet providers. That includes Microsoft, Google, Facebook, and I think Job has a more complete list.
Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, Paltalk, AOL, Skype, YouTube, and Apple.
Yeah.
Chances are you used at least one and probably about seven or eight of those.
And the NSA has always claimed that they only look at this information as it relates to foreign nationals using this data on American companies. But
in fact, their charter specifically precludes them from investigating or monitoring domestic.
Yeah, but you can bet that that's not the case because many, many, many Americans engage in internet usage where you're visiting foreign websites. So your data is going to be swept up and analyzed as well. Now, these things And this one in particular, the PRISM program, has been going on for at least the last 6 years. That's what we know. Now, these comprehensive data collection activities have been authorized by the USA Patriot Act and by subsequent extensions of its provisions, which means Congress has reviewed and signed off on these things in spite of warnings from members of the Senate Intelligence Committee that this is not a good idea.
Yeah, the section of the Patriot Act in particular is called the Business Records Provision. It allows the government to essentially subpoena the business records of a company if they suspect that there's information there that may assist in a terrorist investigation. The thing is, of course, this is an extraordinarily broad interpretation of that provision. And in particular, Senators Ron Wyden from Oregon and Tom Udall from Colorado have been, both members of the Senate Intelligence Committee, have been saying for a couple of years to anybody who will listen that if the American people only knew how broadly the Obama administration was interpreting this, they would be outraged. This is what they were talking about.
Yeah. And so we had President Obama come out this week and say his argument in defense of this program. And this is a direct quote. He said, "It's important to recognize that you can't have 100% security and also then have 100% privacy and zero inconvenience." That's a direct quote. That's exactly what he said. And I'd like to say that, you know, he is right, but... is 100% security obtainable, and is it even desirable if it means you have to give up your rights under the Constitution?
You can't have 100% security,
no.
Period. Life doesn't work that way.
That's exactly right. And, you know, you could live in a padded cell, and you wouldn't have 100% security, and you certainly wouldn't enjoy that life, I have to tell you that. So
is that personal experience?
Given, yeah.
We're in a padded room right now.
That's
like
true.
We are soundproofed.
So really what it boils down to is a question of priorities. Do we put people in little cocoons and we tell them you'll be 100% safe? Or do we want to live with the expectation that we'll have some privacy, some freedom of speech, freedom of association, and the right to assemble and our rights under the Constitution, you know, and not have to live in a surveillance state?
Yeah.
I want to point out, too, that the effectiveness of this data collection is questionable, too, because it didn't pick up the Tsarnaev brothers and it didn't stop the Boston Marathon bombing. Again, as Jobs said, you can't have 100% security. Life is hazardous.
And you know, it's not just that it isn't effective on its own merits, but even if it were somewhat effective, given the cost, both the monetary cost and the cost to people's privacy, people's constitutional rights, civil rights, and so forth. There's a balance that needs to be struck there, and this isn't even close to a balance. You know, you can't have 100% security when the people who are supposedly keeping you secure represent the biggest threat.
Yeah, for a lot of people who are innocent, swept up in the surveillance state, and there are a number of them. Or if you're someone who is young and a little bit stupid and you say the wrong thing, and then you're led by the FBI into a sting, I don't think that's a good use of resources.
And that's even if it's being used as it's supposedly designed to be used. The potential for abuse there for political purposes or other purposes, ideological purposes, other purposes, is extraordinary. And if you trust the Obama administration on that, you might not trust the next folks.
Exactly.
I found it amusing that the president stated that no names, don't worry, no names were grabbed with the phone data. It's like, as if, you know, you can't tie that to it later.
As if you need a person's name.
you don't need their name when you have their genome. Come on.
The government only needs your social security number as a unique some other number as a unique identifier. They don't need a name to put a face to you and your activities.
Yeah, and in fact, for what they plan to do to you, it's better if they don't know your name.
Yeah, because it humanizes you in their eyes.
All right. Anything else on this?
There's more.
Okay. There will be more eventually, yes.
Yeah. Related to this Supreme Court ruling
this week? Yeah, this week a terrible ruling by the Supreme Court that police can take your DNA and keep it in a database if you're detained for any reason and regardless of whether you are eventually convicted of a crime or if you are let go without charges.
A ruling that is so bad that Anthony Scalia's dissent actually made sense.
Yeah, it was really terrible. So, you know, as Jobs says, they don't need your name. You know, if all they need to do is detain you and take a cheek swab, and you're good to go. Whether or not they ever decide to charge you or convict you, your DNA will then be in police databases, which, of course, are shared all over the United States now, and also with foreign governments. So, you know, this is a ruling, I think, that people need to be calling their congressmen and say, you know, the Supreme Court made this horrible ruling. It's time you guys passed a law about it.
Yeah. And again, you know, the Fourth Amendment against search and seizure has been so badly eroded over the last 30 or 40 years. You know, it's yet another step in the wrong direction for a piece of the Bill of Rights that basically no longer has any meaning.
Yeah.
We actually didn't plan to talk about it, but I just remembered that also this week the New York State Senate passed a law that if you annoy a policeman, you can be thrown in jail. It still has to go to their assembly house.
I don't think that's very different from actual practice, but
but they use the word annoy in the actual text of the law.
That's like, is that legally defined, what annoy means?
I suspect somewhere it is. All right, let's move on. And
what if the assembly annoys the rest of us? Is that prosecutable?
What if the Republicans annoy the rest of us?
Let's move on
to Tea Party
developments with at the Senate Armed Services Committee this week.
Yeah, speaking of annoying Republicans and Tea Parties, the Senate Armed Services Committee has a number of subcommittees that oversee various aspects of the armed forces, and various activists and proponents have been trying to get Congress to pay more attention to the epidemic of sexual assault and harassment and gender-based violence that has been going on in the armed forces over the last number of years, and especially in the last decade as we've been prosecuting two active wars. The subcommittee on personnel in the Senate is I believe the only subcommittee of the Armed Services Committee that's chaired by a woman. There are three women actually on the committee. And so they held a hearing this week talking about that epidemic of sexual assault. Now, it tells you what kind of culture they're taking on, that there were 18 people, or 20 people, I'm sorry, called to testify in that panel. 18 of them were against the reform being put forward by Kirsten Hillebrand, the senator from New York, that would require that supervisors in the military not be allowed to adjudicate sexual assault charges against their own subordinates. 18 of the 20 witnesses were opposed to that reform, and the two that were pro-reform were civilians. And of course, you know, the folks who have actually been assaulted while serving in the military, men or women, were somehow lost in the mail.
None of them were there to testify.
No, none. Well, they might have been there. None of them were invited to testify. Yeah. So the folks who were there, who were anti-reform, were grilled pretty hard by the three women on the subcommittee about why the military isn't doing more to stem sexual assault and sexual violence, because it really has grown to epidemic proportions over the last several years and has gotten a lot of attention for that. And because of that, people on the right went nuts. You know, radio talk show hosts and elected officials and such talking about, you know, how the reputation of our boys in uniform was being smeared and so forth. And we had this, you know, something about conservatives and people in the Tea Party that they just can't help revealing how much they think rape really is a cool thing. So we had Senator Saxby Chambliss from Georgia, the same guy who got elected a few years back by sliming a triple amputee Vietnam War vet for as being indistinguishable from Osama bin Laden, with this quote: "The young folks coming into each of your services are anywhere from 17 to 22 or 23. Gee whiz, the hormone level created by nature sets in place the possibility for these types of things to occur. So we've got to be very careful on our side." Didn't make clear what his side was.
Yeah,
but
that shows a level of ignorance that is astounding.
It's because, like, the victims, where do you start?
Because the victims of these sexual assaults are the 18 to 23-year-old men and women, and the perpetrators of these sexual assaults in the military are often their superiors or senior level folks who are training them who are much older and have power over them. It just shows a level of ignorance that is inexcusable in a person who's supposed to be representing us in Congress.
And not just that, but you mentioned the key word there, power. It also misunderstands the nature of rape.
Exactly.
It's not driven by sexual hormones. It's a crime of power. Mm-hmm. And you know, you can deconstruct it all you want, but it just, again, this was not a comment made in isolation. There's a lot of this stuff going on the right in response to this. And, you know, again, what is it about rape and sexual assault that gets these guys, and it almost always is guys, so defensive and so dismissive? I can't imagine.
Yeah. Well, and just the amount of ignorance in the Republican caucus in Congress is just astounding to me. And we see that too in the whole IRS investigation, where they can't be bothered to even look at the fact that these Tea Party groups whose applications were being analyzed were actually engaging in political activities. You know, so it's like, look, dudes, if you're going to make a big deal out of something, at least try to find the facts. But they can't even go that far.
And the other thing on the military sexual assault is if you make the argument, and let's just say for the sake of yucks and grins that this is a credible argument, if you make the argument that the boys just can't help themselves, well, what does that say about the military training? Aren't soldiers supposed to be taught self-discipline and you know, cohesion and all that kind of thing? So you're also basically insulting our men and women in uniform. So why do these Republicans hate America so much? And it just really just makes no sense at all. But it shows you how committed to a certain patriarchal vision of not just our military and our society, but biological functions. And I imagine there's something in there about magical vaginas that don't get these victims pregnant, but we'll set that aside for today.
Right, let's move on to this week's economic news.
Yeah, this week the New York Times ran an article, and the title of that article was "Behind the Rise in House Prices, Wall Street Buyers." And it was a very interesting article because it pointed out that the rise in home prices in most markets in the U.S. today is due to speculation by hedge funds and real estate investment trusts, essentially large investment companies that have pooled the money of extremely rich people around the country.
Because they're the only ones left with the money.
Yeah, are going around the country and buying up single-family homes to rent them out as an investment strategy. Prices have been rising by double digits in many housing markets, including here in Seattle, and that's pricing out ordinary families who are trying to buy homes, even small local investors who, you know, a person who might buy a second home as an investment thing to fix it up and resell it, they find the prices too steep and they can't get in on it. That really is the sign of a second bubble forming. For example, Blackstone, one of the largest investment companies on Wall Street, now owns about 26,000 single-family homes in 9 states, and they're looking to buy more. And this even applies to fixer-uppers. Across the nation, 68% of all damaged houses that were sold in April were bought by investment companies, and only 19% were bought by first-time home buyers. I think that's an astounding figure. But think for a minute, not just about this in economic terms, but think about this in social terms. When you've given huge tax breaks to the extremely wealthy and they have so much cash they can't find enough things to do with it.
And nobody else does.
Yeah, what do they do with their huge surplus of cash? Well, and they start buying up homes, and middle and lower class families can't afford to own the major asset that they're supposed to be able to own in their lifetime, which usually is the core piece of how people build wealth in America. And what you end up with is you end up with the vast majority of people as renters, as tenants, literally, to the ultra-rich. What does this sound to you like?
Feudalism.
It sounds like feudalism, right? And I don't think anybody could argue that that's a good trend.
I think the wealthy would.
Yeah. But then you also have to
ask. I think Congress would.
You also have to ask, too, what's going to happen when those investors want to sell those properties en masse? What's going to happen to the housing market? Well, the bubble will burst. And so this idea that investors can jump in and out of the market at any time will make the housing market much, much more volatile, just like it's made the stock market.
All right. Well, the bubble bursting, moving on to, it sounds like a burst in Turkey this week.
Yeah, protests in Turkey all this past week. It's more than just about the development of the last green space in the center of Istanbul. It's also about the rapid commercial redevelopment of the entire country. And currently, economists who look at Turkey are saying that the levels of private bank debt and the levels of overbuilding of real estate in overdeveloping of real estate in Turkey are very, very similar to what Ireland and Spain looked like prior to their economic crashes.
Wait a minute. I thought Ireland and Spain, the problem was too much government spending.
Oh, no. It was private bank debt and real estate bubbles. But there's also been discontent, too, in Turkey over Erdogan's government, his crackdown on independent journalists so that now there's only state-owned media to report the news, and his crackdown on freedom of speech and his extreme dislike for social media, which is the only way people can get real news in Turkey.
Yeah, and again, in all the coverage of this that's happened in American media this week, the role of the United States in supporting Erdogan's government and particularly the military. The U.S. has a long and complicated relationship with the Turkish military in the Middle East, and they are a NATO member, and they have been used extensively as a staging area both for Iraq and for Afghanistan, and now for funneling arms to rebels
Syria.
In Syria,
mm-hmm.
Which is right on Turkey's border, as Iraq is in the southeast and Kurdistan. But and of course, you know, they're seen as a counterweight to Israel in the region, and the U.S. Intervened to broker a sort of a detente in the relationship between Turkey and Israel earlier this year that erupted over the Gaza Freedom Flotillas a couple 3 years ago. So, you know, with all of that context, the severe police repression that's been going on of protesters in Istanbul this week has been done with weaponry and training provided by American taxpayers. And once again, you know, the United States' role in supporting that kind of repression in that part of the world, very much not noticed by American media.
Phenomenal coverage, though, if you go on the internet to see
yeah,
the photos
there is.
Yes.
Of so many people out in the streets.
And mm-hmm. Yes.
Like I say, that's the only way Turks can get news about what's going on. And so they post it, and we can see it as well.
Yes, and you have Erdogan saying that Twitter is the greatest menace in the world or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So.
Well, there's a reason they shut down internet access in Egypt and
yeah, just,
Syria.
Just think how much of a menace it'd be if they allowed 200 characters. I mean, gosh.
All right. Events.
Yeah. Speaking of Turkey, Save Turkish Democracy protests will be happening today here in Seattle. That going on at 1 o'clock down at Victor Steinbrück Park at the north end of Pike Place Market. Go down and express your support for the protesters in Istanbul. Also this afternoon, you can make a sort of a downtown afternoon of it from 3 to 5. They'll be picketing at the Seattle Science Festival Science Expo outside the Pacific Science Center. So what could possibly be wrong with a science festival? Well, the War Profiteers, for one thing, the featured exhibitors Lockheed Martin and Boeing, which are the country's two biggest military contractors, and a good measure for that, for a matter of where a lot of U.S. science funding is going these days. So the picketing, sponsored by Veterans for Peace and Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action, and folks are going to be meeting at 3 p.m. at the corner of 2nd Avenue and Thomas Street near the Pacific Science Center in Belltown. And then on this coming Thursday, the 13th of June, there will be a rally to encourage regents of the University of Washington to divest from fossil fuel. That will be 12:30 on the Hub Lawn of the University of Washington main campus here in Seattle, 12:30 on Thursday. Go and help students who actually will have to live with the impact of climate change get our regents who won't to actually do something about it.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat This State. And where do people find Eat This State?
www.eatthestate.org.